From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. All right, well, the title tonight, Learning to Love the Sovereignty of God. Hopefully you already love it, but it seems like a good topic, first of all, because even if you do love the sovereignty of God, maybe you can love it more, or maybe you can understand it more, or maybe you can help people who aren't there yet. We all know people who struggle with the sovereignty of God, and I suspect we all certainly have struggled in the past and still do, probably in some ways. And Sunday morning or Sunday night, I can't remember, but I had in the outline I was going to use Peter as an example on how there's a kind of a process sometimes. And really, we're all in a lifetime process of growing in Christ. And there is definitely a process in terms of understanding God's control and then getting to a place where you, okay, I believe it, and then getting to a place where you love it and you're joyful about the fact that God's in control. And so there's a process that takes place in all of us, and I think you can clearly see it in the life of Peter, and so that's really what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to use him as an example in learning to love the sovereignty of God, and as we do, hopefully it'll resonate with us, and we'll see, that kind of sounds like how I was. I went through some of those stages, and you know other people that, like I said, hopefully we can help along the way in that regard. Because when you think about struggling with that idea, that God's in control of everything, I mean, most people, if you talk to them and you talk about God being powerful, they don't struggle with that. I mean, if they profess to be Christians, they don't struggle with that idea. They're fine with God being powerful. They're just not fine with him being all-powerful. Because what's been drilled into their heads from day one is that, you have power over you. And so it's a free will thing that they've been taught, and most of the time they're taught that, well, that in essence is higher than God's sovereignty. Now, they might not come out and say that, but what they'll say a lot of times is, well, yeah, God's more powerful than I am, but he chooses not to interfere and everything is up to me in life. Well, it's not taking away the fact that you're accountable for your actions, you certainly are, but to try to limit the sovereignty of God is not only unbiblical, it's dangerous to adopt such a mindset. Now, like I said, everybody struggles with it in various ways, and for a couple of reasons that I'll point out before we get to the actual outline there. Sometimes things happen and we just don't want to believe that God allowed something to happen. Well, I just don't believe God would do that, or God would allow that, And you encounter that type of mindset a lot of times, particularly if somebody's going through something that's really difficult, and they're fine attributing that to Satan, and maybe Satan did have a role in that. But in terms of whether or not God is sovereign even over Satan. And so people struggle with that idea and say, well, it's hard to know that, I can't believe God would allow that to happen. Now, how do we deal with that personally? We have to deal with that first and foremost by saying, regardless of whether or not I understand why God allowed that, God knows more than I do. And he may be using this in ways far beyond anything I'll ever know. And really, that's what faith is all about. It's trusting God, not just in who he is, but in what he does, that he knows more than I do. And he is working all things for good, even if I don't understand. Now, how do you deal with somebody else who's struggling with that? Now, that can be a little different. I think if somebody else is struggling with the sovereignty of God, and how could God let this happen and that sort of thing, I think as Christians we have to be extraordinarily gracious and patient with people like that. Because you could just give them truth, but if you give them truth like a, you know, like a sledgehammer, it may not have the effect, whereas if you were a little more skilled with the truth or patient with the truth and kind of maybe God's going to bring them along slowly through a trial rather than, you know, hammering them with something like that. I think, you know, a few years ago I had to have a surgery where they took my gallbladder out, and the first surgeon I went to was a Russian or somewhere over there. And my doctor had recommended him to me, and I went and talked to the guy, and he had my, you know, my records and everything. And my question was, the reason I wanted to talk to a surgeon is, in your opinion, do I need this surgery or do I not? Wow, what do you think a surgeon's going to say? Excuse me, Mr. Car Salesman, do you think I need to buy a car? And so he says, oh, you want to go buy that out? I take it out. I said, no, I want to know your opinion, professional opinion. Do I need it? Well, it's a gallbladder. Who cares? You don't need it. You want me to take it out? I take it out. Well, but I don't want to have the surgery if I don't really need it. You know, if it's not really going to improve anything and my symptoms, you know, plus it costs money. And oh, well, you want it out? I take it out. I almost had the idea that guy would have pinned me down right there on the spot and ripped out the knife and took it out. Now, had he done that, technically he would have fixed my problem. Bad gallbladder, now gone. But I would have argued, you know, he could have gone about that much more graciously. He could have handled it a whole lot better. Now, he didn't do that, by the way. I did say, you know what, I think I'm going to get a second opinion. Thank you. And so I ended up going and seeing another surgeon, Barry Newton. Some of you know him. Good Christian guy. Now, his approach was completely different. Actually, my doctor had referred me to him because I griped about the other surgeon. I said, that guy is just a butcher. He just, you know. Well, you need to go see Barry Newton because I promise you, if you don't need the surgery, he'll tell you flat out you don't need it. And so I went and talked to him. He said, yeah, you do need it. And but it was a whole lot different perspective, you know. For example, we talked about it, and then when I got there, they prepped me for surgery, and Aaron was in there with me, and he came in and explained what he was going to do, and this is why it's going to help you. And then, heaven forbid, he prayed with me before the surgery. Prayed with Aaron and I, and he, you know, and he told me flat out, he said, look, I've never messed one of these up in my life, but that doesn't mean you won't be the first. So you just need to know that going in. I appreciate that. I want the honesty. But when you think about that, I mean, you take something like the sovereignty of God, you can take the first approach to that and just say, hey, God is sovereign, and just kind of hammer people with it in such a way that you told them the truth, but maybe it could have been done in a whole lot better way. And so I do think we have to be gracious as we deal with people and realize it's not surprising that they struggle with it. You probably struggle with it at some point. Maybe you didn't, but most people do. And why is it you don't now? Well, because God revealed something to you, and he probably did it over time. Maybe not, maybe just one event. But we struggle with the sovereignty of God, one reason, because we don't want to believe God allowed something to happen. Or a second primary reason is because we know God allowed it to happen, but we don't know why. Now, that's not really a struggle with the sovereignty of God, because if you say, I know God's sovereign, I know God ordained this to happen, I just don't know why he would do it. A lot of times, what that is more of an attack, not so much on sovereignty, but on God's goodness. Because I know he's all-powerful, but why would he let this happen? I don't think it should have happened. Therefore, the argument, the logical conclusion, God's not good. Now, how would we answer that? For starters, I would argue that our definition of good is marred. We don't know what good is. We know what might seem good to us. But is that good for the whole universe? Is that good for God's glory? Is that good for your neighbor? Not necessarily. I mean, we see what's good and bad as typically what's good for us. Even a lot of times, if we have a loved one dying or something, it's why do we not want them to die? Because I'm going to miss them. Well, if they're a believer, they're going to heaven. That's looking at it from God's perspective. That's looking at it from an eternal perspective. And I've talked about this just recently. I think last Wednesday night, how God is sovereign even over bad things. I gave several of examples. You go to the garden in the fall. God was sovereign over that, and he had a plan that he would be glorified in his son paying for sin, but sin wouldn't have entered the world had it not happened way back in the garden. It was all God's plan. The imprisonment of Joseph, remember that? You meant evil, God meant good. Not God spun good, God meant good. This was ordained of God, bad things to happen to Joseph, so good things would end up happening that Joseph didn't know anything about. Certainly his brothers didn't know anything about, because they meant evil against him. The testing of Job, of course, I mean, you look at that and what comes through the end of that is God being extremely glorified in Job's final response and his final condition. None of that would have happened had he not gone through what he had gone through at the first. Most obvious example, the cross of Christ, evil from the perspective of those who killed him. Good from the perspective of it was God's preordained plan to pay for our sins. If he didn't go to the cross, we go to hell. So I see it as a good thing that Christ went to the cross. And finally, I talked about the martyrdom of Stephen. After Stephen was martyred, it says in the scripture that the church began to fan out and take the gospel with them. And so churches came into being as an indirect result of Stephen being martyred, because as they went, they took the gospel. All right, so we get to Peter here because he's our case study tonight on learning to love the sovereignty of God. And here's where I'm going with this, specifically as it pertains to Peter's idea of the cross, Jesus' cross, not Peter's cross, the cross of Christ, the crucifixion. There was a time in which Peter did not understand that as being God's will. And it certainly wasn't Peter's will. And that's the passage I just read, by the way. It is without question that it was God's will for Jesus to be crucified. And Jesus began to tell the disciples that very thing. And Peter would hear nothing of it. That's when he rebukes Jesus. It was clearly not Peter's plan for Jesus to be crucified, and at that time, Peter seemed to think it wasn't God's plan either. Jesus didn't know what he was talking about, which is kind of odd, particularly given who Jesus was talking to Peter there, and I'll get to that in a minute. So that's what I'm looking at tonight, when Peter rebukes Jesus, then when he attacks Malchus, that tells us something, and then he preaches predestination a little bit later, then he embraces suffering, and he rests finally in the sovereignty of God. All right. Peter rebukes Jesus, number one. Passage I just read, so I won't read the whole thing again. But it's fascinating when you look at this passage here in Matthew 16, that he would do this. This is one of a man known to shoot his mouth off more than he should, Peter. But even he, you have to say, wow, this really took some nerve, that he would pull Jesus aside and begin to rebuke him. And the way it's worded there, he began to rebuke him. It sounds as though this wasn't going to just be a one or two word rebuke. He was going to just tear into it. He's going to give him a lecture. Just a nice long chewing out about how foolish Jesus is with this notion of getting himself killed. Well, that's just not going to happen. Peter just can't handle that. Now, the first question that arises, I think, or at least first question that arose for me, does Peter understand who he's talking to? I mean, yes, he knows he's talking to Jesus, but does he understand at this point, does he understand who Jesus is? In other words, does he understand Jesus is God? Or is he still not got that far in his theology yet? I mean, he thinks Jesus is somebody great, Jesus is the Messiah, but he doesn't have I mean, there were some people in that time that had a concept of the Messiah just being a person. A deliverer who would come and defeat Rome and set up a Jewish earthly kingdom. Is Peter thinking that Jesus is just a carpenter from Nazareth who's the Messiah? Or does he understand Jesus is divine? Any thoughts?
He didn't understand
Yeah, he certainly doesn't understand the cross as a part of redemptive plan. He doesn't see that at all. That's clear. But does he understand who Jesus is at this point? But yeah, Andrew?
When Jesus asked, who do men say that
Uh-huh.
Did he answer and say, "Thou art Son of God"?
He did. But did he do that before this or after this? Strangely enough, he did it 5 verses before this. Isn't that something? Because you read the passage here starting in 21, where Peter begins to rebuke Jesus, and I thought the same thing. I thought, I know when Jesus said, "Who do the people say that I am?" At that point, Peter declares that he knows Jesus to be the Son of God. And I had to think, I thought, well, where did he say that, though, in Scripture, chronologically speaking? And then when I did the little search, it's in the same chapter, 5 verses earlier. So literally, when you think of that, well, let's just read it. Look up in Matthew 16, verse 13. "Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?'" And notice how Jesus phrased that. Who do they say the Son of Man is? Jesus didn't say, "Who do they say the Son of God is?" Hint, 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 hint. Who do they say the Son of Man is? Which, granted, the Son of Man is a title in the Old Testament that many would say is messianic. But who do they say the Son of Man is? Verse 14. They say, some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who's in heaven revealed this." Now here's what's so fascinating about that is right there, Peter declares something that Jesus said was divinely inspired. Yeah. Peter utters something here. "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, in essence, "That didn't come from you, Peter. You didn't figure that out. My Father revealed that to you. Therefore, you are blessed." That's why he calls him blessed rather than smart. And so he declares something that God had revealed to Peter, who Jesus was. Peter declares it, and 5 verses later, he's rebuking the one he just declared to be the Son of God. That's fascinating to me. When you think you've accomplished something spiritually, watch out. And this is not even Peter, you know. Jesus declares to him that God revealed it to him. And so God really did reveal some truth to him there. And 5 verses later, I mean, it's amazing how fast you can go from divinely inspired truth, and 5 verses later, you're just practically blaspheming that quickly. Okay, you know it's the Son of God. How in the world can you take him aside and rebuke him on anything if you just declared that you know who he is? Okay, so that's interesting when you think about Peter, his understanding of who he was talking to. He does appear to have understood who he was talking to. He just thought he knew better than God on the matter. Now, another couple of things to notice here in Matthew 16 is further down here, the account between Jesus and Peter over the rebuke. Jesus counter-rebukes him. I think a lot of times we don't expect that. We expect, Jesus could say, "Oh, well, you don't quite have it right. Let me help you out here," you know, something. Jesus just hammers right back at him, doesn't he? And there's a reason, I think, because this is massive. I mean, you can be off on little theological things, and, you know, you think of Apollos. Not that his wasn't massive, but it was just ignorance on his part. He'd never been taught. He didn't know. Peter should have known better than to question Jesus, all right? So you remember Apollos, he was unsure on some things or wrong on some things, and Priscilla and Aquila took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. Jesus just right back to Peter. Peter rebukes him, and Jesus turns around and calls him Satan. And so it's interesting on the counter-rebuke, but here's another question. When he calls him Satan, is Jesus calling him Satan, or is Jesus talking to Satan? "Get behind me, Satan." Is he calling Peter Satan, or is he talking to Satan? Any thoughts on that? You understand the question I'm asking here? Okay. Certainly a Satan-inspired statement that Peter was making. Other thoughts?
Well, he goes on to say, though, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God.
Right. Or
look
at verse 23. It kind of sets it up for us. Before Jesus even says anything, notice what it says. He turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." And so when you read that, it looks as though he's calling Peter Satan. He's definitely addressing Peter. I mean, you can, you know, like Jesus addresses a demon. Somebody's got a legion of demons in them. He talks directly to the person. I mean, if you were standing there watching, it looks like he's talking to a person. But he's addressing the demons inside. And so there definitely, you know, could be that going on. He's talking to Peter, but Peter, what you just said was of the devil. And so he could be talking to Peter and talking to Satan at the same time. Another thing you can consider, I don't think this is the answer, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway just for you to mentally chew on it. The word Satan means something. It's not only a proper name. The word Satan, if you do the history on it, you go all the way back to the Hebrew, it means accuser or adversary. Sometimes the word could be used with a lowercase to call someone an opponent, an enemy. Satan, I think, is how it's pronounced in Hebrew. That's not the case here, I believe, because I dug into the Greek New Testament here to see, just out of curiosity, when he said, "Get behind me, Satan," did he use a capital S? In the Greek, does it record it with a capital S or a lowercase S? Because that'll tell you, is it a proper name? Because just like Greek, just like English, they use a capital for a proper name. Well, it's a capital. So it's a proper name when he says, get behind me, Satan. All right. Like I said, another thing to keep in mind, it is definitely Satan-inspired, what he says, because what's he doing? He's trying to get Jesus to avoid the cross. Now, on the surface, it just looks like he's trying to protect his friend, right? His friend says, "I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to get killed." And Peter says, "This will never happen." Specifically, he says, "God will never let this happen." Which is so strange, because he knows who Jesus is. The Son of God, he knows Jesus to be divine. The NAS says, "God forbid it, Lord, this will never happen." What it literally says in the Greek is, "God be gracious to you, Lord." In other words, God will be gracious. God won't let this happen to you. You won't get killed. God will keep his hand upon you, the Father. He'll keep his hand upon you. He'll protect you in Jerusalem. He's not going to let you get killed. Come on, Jesus, the pressure's getting to you. What are you talking about? You're going to get killed. So Peter's trying to encourage him with a rebuke. Now, when you just think of that, though, this is not Peter and Andrew. This is not Peter and John. This is Peter and the Son of God. So Peter's going to correct him. Now, another interesting thing, and this ties in specifically, I think, to the sovereignty question, which is kind of the main point tonight, is what specifically Jesus says to him after he calls him Satan. Verse 23, he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's." Obviously, the idea there of him being a stumbling block. In other words, Jesus is on a mission, and Peter, what you're saying would mess up that mission. You're getting in my way. But the fascinating thing that he says there to Peter, right at the very start when he counter-rebukes him, verse 23, he turned to Peter and said, "Get behind me." That's a powerful little statement there. Get behind me. I mean, you get in an argument with somebody, do you typically say that? I don't. I'd probably get my head knocked off if I did. Get behind me. I mean, what is that implying? It's implying you're the boss. It's implying you don't tell me what to do. It's implying, last time I checked, there was only one Lord here, Peter, and it was me. You get behind me. And furthermore, Satan, get behind me. And so, you think of all the things Jesus could have said there. He could have, you know, told Satan to shut up, or he could have said, "Look, Peter, you're getting duped by Satan. When you say that, obviously Satan is tricking you into saying something that's inaccurate and wrong." Jesus doesn't give him a lecture. There's time for a lecture, and there's time for a whooping. And he gives him a whooping because he was going to give Jesus a whooping. And I, you know, I'm not saying anytime somebody rebukes you that you should, you're not Jesus. You might very well be wrong. You might need the rebuke. But Jesus didn't. And he didn't take it. And so that's, to me, that's an interesting response. If you want to know who Jesus is and the power and authority that he has, it's not only in the fact that he doesn't take that rebuke from Peter, and he doesn't have to. In fact, he needs to correct Peter, what Peter just said. It's not just the fact that Jesus counter-rebukes him. It's not just the fact that he calls him Satan in the process and a stumbling block, but that he also says, get behind me. I'm the sovereign one, not you. Sometimes God's got to say that to us too, doesn't he? We think we know it all. It's proven that we don't. He may not say it in, you know, verbal and this sort of thing, but you've had moments in your life when you realize God just told me to get behind him. And then finally, he says this, you're setting your mind on man's interests, not God's. In other words, now this is what another interesting thing, because what's motivating Peter here to rebuke Jesus? I mean, if you give him the benefit of the doubt, you say, you know, he's concerned about Jesus. He doesn't want Jesus to get killed. He seems to be concerned that Jesus is cracking under the stress. I mean, he knows there's people that want to kill him. And now Jesus is just saying, you know what, that's it, we're going to get ourselves killed. And Peter's like, no, Jesus needs, he just needs to settle down. He needs a good talking to. His intentions, you assume his intentions are good. Even if you say he really is trying to help Jesus, Jesus points out, but you're not focused on God's plan. That's the point. Your interest is on man. And so if it's a human-type interest on Jesus and hoping he can keep Jesus from getting killed, he's wrong, because it's God's plan for Jesus to get killed. Furthermore, if it's a human-type interest in the sense of he's thinking of himself, I think that's a big part of it, by the way, that's wrong too. Now, we know, even after all this was said and done, when the crucifixion was over, these boys were still, you go to Acts 1, they're still asking Jesus, if now is the time in which you will restore the kingdom to Israel. They had an earthly kingdom on their mind even after the cross. They never did drop that, I would say, until later on. Certainly when Jesus was still on the earth, up to the ascension even, they are still thinking of an earthly kingdom. Is now the time, Acts 1, is now the time which you're going to restore the kingdom of Israel? And Jesus tells them, mind your own business. It's not for you to know things like that. And so it wouldn't be surprising to see that Peter is very much focused on his own interests. He wants an earthly kingdom. The idea of him being the vice president and Jesus being the president sounds pretty appealing to him. And when Jesus starts talking about getting killed, that's ruining Peter's plan. But Peter, what about God's plan? You're not listening to God. You're listening to Satan when you tell Jesus, rebuke Jesus, saying, oh, it's not going to happen to you. All right, so Peter rebukes Jesus. At this point, he doesn't understand the sovereignty of God at all as it pertains to the cross. He doesn't see it. He doesn't understand it. The next item on the agenda is Peter attacks Malchus. All right, so, you know, some time has passed now. We get to the night of the arrest, John 18, verse 10. I'll read just a couple of verses here. Simon Peter then, this is when they came to arrest Jesus. Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, and this is the telling part right here that we're going to dig into, Jesus said to Peter, put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? The cup that the Father has given me. Jesus was just praying about a cup, wasn't he? Peter would have known that if he'd stayed awake, by the way. Let this cup pass from me, but not my will, thine be done. I wish Peter would have heard that and taken it to heart, because then when they came to arrest him, which was the plan, rather than ripping out a sword and swinging, maybe Peter would have looked to Jesus and said, is this the plan? But Peter wasn't the type to look really to anyone and ask their opinion of the plan, even Jesus. All right, so why does Peter do this? This whole idea of Peter, and just to set the scene a little bit, okay? So you've got Jesus and a handful of disciples here praying. Judas comes up. He's the betrayer. The soldiers, the Roman soldiers that would have come, would have numbered somewhere between 300 and 600. If you, basing this on John 18:3 and the Greek word that's used there, knowing that they were soldiers who came from the Tower of Antonia, which is in Jerusalem, highly trained. These are Green Beret types because they have to be in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is a city that's frequently in turmoil. And so if you have a revolt, you got to have soldiers there that can put it down quickly. So you don't want a bunch of PFCs there. You want killers. And so these are highly trained, between 300 and 600, most likely. So that's the scene. And don't you, on some level, do you not kind of admire Peter? I mean, what kind of man rips out a sword against those odds? I'm not sure I'd have had the courage to do that, or maybe the stupidity. I mean, one man's courage is another man's stupidity. But Peter, bless his heart, boy, he's going to take them on, isn't he? He rips out that sword, and he's going to take them on. First of all, he swings, and all he hits is an ear. And second of all, he hit was a slave. He missed a soldier, and he missed the head, which was probably what he was going for. But cut him some slack. He's a fisherman. He's not a soldier. All right, so why does he do this? What's motivating him? Why do you think Peter does this? Why does he even pull a sword? I mean, why didn't he just run or argue? Or I mean, what does he think he's going to accomplish with the sword? Any ideas? Well, that's true. He's discombobulated, for one thing. I promise you, if you just wake me up, and I'm liable to pull something on you, too. That could be. Maybe he's thinking, he's going to be the shot heard around the world. It was Peter and his poor aim with that sword. Any other thoughts? Well, it could be a lot of things. I mean, it could just be Peter's a hothead. And, he's obviously been tensed up about the idea of Jesus being arrested and killed. And so when it looks like it's actually going to happen, boom, he loses it. Well, I mean, it's true that he's a hothead, but I don't think that that's the main reason why he does it. Maybe he does it because he loves Jesus. I don't think there's any question that he loves Jesus, but I'm not even sure that that's the primary motivation here. Maybe he thinks he can beat 500 Roman soldiers with one sword. I don't know. I find that hard to believe. If he did think that, he's either highly irrational or he's counting on divine intervention. And like Wes said, maybe he is. Maybe he thinks, hey, it's the beginning of the earthly kingdom. God's going to send a thunderbolt and take care of the rest of these. I just got to cut off one ear and then we're good. Here's the answer. Jesus tells us, I think. The reason he's doing this, he's trying to keep Jesus from getting arrested and crucified. Because when you go all the way back when Peter was rebuking Jesus, that's what it was about. Jesus starts talking about going to Jerusalem and getting killed and being raised on the third day, but Peter didn't even hear that probably. Jesus is talking about being killed, and that's what sets Peter off. And he rebukes him, and Jesus rebukes him back. Get behind me, Satan. But did Peter learn the lesson? No, he didn't learn the lesson, because here all this time later, it's the night for Jesus to get arrested, and Peter comes out swinging. And notice what Jesus says, John 18, verse 11, Jesus said to Peter, put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? And what is that question implying? Peter, you're trying to keep me from drinking it. Is that what you're doing, Peter? Shall I not drink the cup which the Father has given me? That's what your actions are saying. I'm going to keep you from going to the cross. No thank you, Peter. Jesus says no thank you, and we say no thank you because we got 2,000 years hindsight here looking back. It was time for him to go to the cross. He didn't do anything to deserve it, but we did. And so we're thankful that he did. That tells you what Peter was thinking when he did that. Now, again, you step back and you take kind of a forest rather than the tree approach here. Okay, what does Peter understand about the sovereignty of God now as it pertains to the cross? Nothing. He still doesn't understand. He didn't understand when he rebuked Jesus. He didn't understand when he tries to kill Malchus to keep Jesus from being arrested and crucified. All right, well, things happen, don't they? It's a process. It's a process for everybody. We're all in this process of growing in the grace and knowledge of our Lord. And so what happens after this? The cross happens. Of course, Peter denies Christ. That happens. Peter is restored. I'm not going to go into all that, but you know what happens. And then in the early church, you've got the apostles there and Pentecost and all these things. And now listen to Peter, knowing that he didn't know anything about the cross. He did not understand why. Now listen to him in Acts 2 at Pentecost as he's preaching. Specifically notice what he says about the cross. Acts 2, verse 22, "Men of Israel, listen to these words." This is Peter preaching. "Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power." Peter now understands, doesn't he? He understands the cross. Because what does he refer to it as? The predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Now he sees the cross in a completely different light. Now he understands not just the cross, but the sovereignty of God. He's really come a long ways on that theological growth process as it pertains to his understanding of God's control. God's never going to let you get killed. Jesus, what are you talking about? Get behind me, Satan. You don't know what you're talking about. They come to arrest him. What does he do? He pulls the sword. He's going to kill him. And what does Jesus say? Put it away. Am I not going to drink what the cup my Father's given me? Peter, you still don't understand. Now he understands. Acts 2, he understands. This is the preordained plan of God. The cross was not an accident. The cross was not a day in which Jesus took a wrong turn and accidentally went into Jerusalem. That's not what happened. Hey, the Bible says Jesus resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem. He told the disciples why he was going there. And so now Peter understands. Well, it's a learning process. And sometimes, you know, the lessons are hard. The two I'd mentioned, I think it was Sunday or last Wednesday, I can't remember. Job, you remember at the end of Job's whole thing, and what does he say to God? Oh, I know that no plan of yours can be thwarted. He learned that the hard way, maybe, but he learned it. And the same way with Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, no one can stay your hand or say to you, what have you done? Nebuchadnezzar prays and declares that God is sovereign over everything. He didn't used to understand that. He thought he was the most powerful entity in the universe, it sounds like. Look at this, all these things my hands have done. You didn't do nothing. I gave you power, and I'll take it away. And so Peter goes from arguing with Jesus to preaching predestination as it pertains to the cross. All right, he goes on, and Peter even ends up embracing suffering. He was not big on embracing suffering. He was big on killing people that was going to make him embrace suffering. Fascinating thing about Peter, though, and you already know this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, because that's what I do. I tell you things you already know. It's a preacher's job. I tell you things you already know, but you need reminded of them. That's what Peter said, too. I tell you these things by way of reminder. Jesus, this is a part you already know, but I still think it's interesting. Jesus told Peter how he was going to die, didn't he? I don't know if Peter understood. John understood after the fact when he's writing. Maybe Peter understood at the time. I think he did to some extent. John 21, I'm going to read it. Just a few verses. John 21, 18. Again, Peter, he doesn't know the whole plan right here. John 21, 18, "Truly, truly, I say to you," he says, Jesus talking to Peter, "when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished, but when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you." What does that sound like? It sounds exactly like what Jesus is talking about. You will stretch out your hands and somebody else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Now this he said, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. Peter would be crucified. And when he had spoken this, he said to them, or said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, presumably John, following them, the one who had leaned back on Jesus' bosom at the supper and said, Lord, who's the one who betrays you? Peter sees John coming. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Isn't that what you would say if Jesus told you, you're going to get crucified? What about him? You know what Jesus says? None of your business what's going to happen to him. It's none of your business. Peter's hilarious at times. This is a solemn moment, but when you were young, you went anywhere you want, Peter. I mean, he was brash and nobody told him what to do. You went anywhere you want, but when you get old, you'll be stretched out and you'll be taken a place you don't want to go. And John says, Jesus was signifying how Peter was going to die. And Jesus hears this from Jesus. I think he does pick up a little bit on what Jesus is saying. On some level, he knows what Jesus is saying. That's why he says, what about him? What about him? What's going to happen to him? You know how it is when you get uncomfortable news. What do you do when you get uncomfortable news? You change the subject. You deflect it. Okay, I've heard enough about me being crucified. Maybe John's is worse. Can we talk about that? Is he going to be tortured? Actually, John's was worse. You know why? He had to stay on this earth a lot longer than Peter did. You think, well, Peter got crucified. That's a horrible way to die. Yeah, but once he died, it was over. That's how it is for all of us. John lived to be an old man, being persecuted the whole way. Peter seeing him, Lord, what about this man? Jesus said, if I want him to remain till I come, what's that to you? I love that response, too. Jesus says, well, what business is that of yours? If I want him to stay here till I come back, what business is that of yours? You follow me, he says. Therefore, this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say he would not die, only if I want him to remain. What is that to you? So Jesus tells him it's coming. I mean, he tells him what's going to happen. Here's a question for you to consider. If you could know the way you were going to die, would you want to know? Most people answer that pretty quick. So why'd Jesus tell him? I mean, was that obviously it was the correct thing to do because Jesus is perfect. Why did Jesus tell him that? I know, that's what I just said. He's perfect, but why? Why would he tell him? Peter needed humbled, maybe. Yeah, I don't know why he told him completely, other than, you know, you think about it. If you could know how you were going to die and when you were going to die, we just had this conversation earlier, me and somebody. You didn't realize it, but in the last year, you lived through the anniversary of your death. You just don't know what the day is yet. You know, you think back and you say, oh, well, my dad died on December 23rd, and so you probably remember that day. You've already lived through the day of your death, the day that you're going to die. But you didn't know it, right? So you're going to die August 15th, 2050, okay? Today is the anniversary of your death. You just haven't died yet. Now, we don't know any of that, though. Only God knows that. And God doesn't give us the choice. He doesn't tell every person, look, let me know if you want to know when and how you're going to die. I'll pass that on to you. He doesn't do that. David? Oh, teach me to number my days. Right, that's similar. And so he doesn't give us the choice, but sometimes he does give us the information. Well, not us necessarily. He gave Peter some information. He didn't tell him when, but he told him how. And he did tell him a little bit. He said, when you are old, which in other words, you're not going to die next week, Peter. When you are old, this is going to happen. He told Paul some things, too. You remember in Acts 9 when the Lord speaks to Ananias and says, go, for he's a chosen instrument of mine, for I will show him what he must suffer for the sake of my name. I don't know what that means entirely, but I think Paul knew some of what he was going to face. It's interesting to consider that. The closest we get to knowing, really, on that is if we end up with a terminal illness or something. You know, if you get diagnosed, I knew a lady recently that died of a brain tumor. She was diagnosed 4 or 5 years ago. She pretty much knew she was going to die of a brain tumor within the next 4 or 5 years, barring a miracle. And there was no miracle in that regard. Martin Lloyd-Jones died of cancer. He had it for a couple of years before he died. He argued that it was one of the most blessed things to happen in his life. I mean, and not for the reason you might think. You might think, well, he's a godly man, suffering draws you closer to God. I mean, that's all true. But Martin Lloyd-Jones said, for him, it was a time of preparation. He got closer to God in those last 2 years than his whole life, and he was Martin Lloyd-Jones. He was close to God anyway. But the time he had to prepare for death, to walk with the Lord, to have fears eliminated because of that walk with the Lord, to be able to talk to people, to kind of say his goodbyes, that sort of thing. I mean, you always think, what would you rather do? Just, you know, most of us just want to be taken out in our sleep and we wake up in heaven. Martin Lloyd-Jones argued that, well, it wasn't God's will for him and he was glad it wasn't. So you never know. Here's the thing, though. Even if you don't know, though, the clock's ticking. You don't know how you're going to die. You don't have a terminal illness. The clock's ticking on you, though, because there is a day, and God's appointed it. It's coming. And so Peter knows it's coming. He knows what's coming. But now he takes it. He embraces it. Peter suffers for Christ. Acts 4:18 tells of when Peter and John were threatened by the council, remember? And they told him to shut up, stop preaching Jesus. And they said, we're not going to listen to you. We're going to keep on preaching just like we've done. Whether it's right to listen to you, you be the judge, but we're going to listen to God. And so he embraced suffering in doing that. And strangely enough, at the end of his life, 1 Peter chapter 1, he explains the suffering. Listen to what he says. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Boy, Peter, at the end of his life, he understood the sovereignty of God. He understood the cross and why all that happened, and he also understood suffering and why that happened to him. Incredible perspective he has. And finally, that's my last point, number 5. Peter rests in sovereignty. Rest in the sovereignty of God. And that's where we want to get. It's not just enough to say, okay, fine, I accept it begrudgingly. No, that won't work. We have to get to a point where we love the fact that God's in control and that we rest in it. We find joy in it. Yeah, bad things are going to happen to me. That doesn't mean God's not sovereign. It means he knows more than I do. 1 Peter 1:18, Peter resting in the sovereignty of God. He says, you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with the precious blood as of a lamb unblemished, spotless, the blood of Christ. Now, that's Peter at the end of his life, all right? And he refers to Jesus' blood as precious. When Jesus was talking about spilling his blood to Peter back in Matthew 16, Peter did not refer to it as precious. That's crazy talk, Jesus. You're not going to get killed. And now what's he saying? The blood of Christ is precious. Now when he says precious, what he means by that is the same way he uses precious there in terms of silver and gold. It means useful, irreplaceable. You know, we use the word precious in a cutesy way. You see a baby, oh, she's so precious. It wasn't what he meant. He meant precious like a precious metal. It's rare. In Jesus' case, his blood, not only rare, the only thing that will do the job. And he mentions there your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers. There was a time which Peter thought being Jesus' vice president was as good as it could possibly get, and now he's like, that's futility. There's something bigger. He sees the death of Christ as precious, as valuable, as irreplaceable, and he finally, at this point, sees the sovereignty of God as absolute. God was sovereign over the cross. He ordained it. God was sovereign over my suffering. He ordained it. And now Peter's getting ready to get crucified. That's ordained of God too. Glory be to God. And so he finally knows and understands the sovereignty of God, and hopefully we do too.